Good morning, everyone. This is Dr. Campbell, Board Chair. I'm going to go ahead and call the meeting to order. It is now 8 a.m., December the 11th, 2024, for the State of Arizona Board of Podiatry Examiners. I will ask, Heather has been taking roll call, obviously, as people are calling in, and we just need to confirm that we do have a quorum.
Yes, Madam Chair, all board members are present.
Thank you. And we have our guests on the line also. At this time, does anyone have any declaration for conflict of interest of any agenda item? Please let us know now. Hearing none, we will move on to number four, which is a review, discussion, and possible action on board meeting minutes. These are minutes from last month, November the 13th, 2024. We have the general session minutes. Does anyone have any additions or corrections for those general session meeting minutes? Hearing none, then I'll make a motion to accept our general session meeting minutes from November 13th, 2024, as there are no additions or corrections.
Seconded.
Thank you, Dr. Foreman. It's been moved and seconded to second to accept the general session minutes from meeting 11-13-24. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are accepted. Our next are executive session minutes from that same date. You all have received an addendum to your board packet from Ms. Broaddus in regards to some wording changes in that those executive session minutes. Does anyone have any objection to those corrections? Hearing none, then I will make a motion to accept the executive session minute.
Second.
Just, I haven't finished the motion, just a second. Accept the executive session minutes from 11-13-24 with corrections made. Do I have a second?
Seconded by
Jonathan
Gray.
Thank you. It's been moved and seconded to accept the executive session minutes of 11-13-24 with corrections made. All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? The minutes of executive session are accepted. All right, now we'll move on to number four, which is our items for review, discussion, and possible action. We'll begin with our investigation files. Is Dr. Saunders on the line?
I am here, yes.
There you are. Okay, so we'll begin with the first case, which is complaint number 24-06-C, which is Dr. Katlia Gorman. Dr. Gorman is present online on the phone with her counsel, Mr. Bruce Crawford. The complainant KG is not present, so we're going to go ahead and hear from Dr. Saunders his report, and then from Dr. Gorman and Mr. Crawford. So, Dr. Saunders, please proceed.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for taking this first. So the investigation here, it was quite a lengthy report. There's a lot of duplication of the notes, and I'll summarize it here as we go along here. Initially here, the complainant, she gave a report there, but she's basically unhappy with the outcome of the experience. Dr. Gorman, she required a couple of surgeries, and ultimately had to go to another provider. She basically is just putting in her complaint that she's unhappy with the entire experience. I did try to contact this patient several times. I never got through this patient. So I couldn't confirm any other details of the complaint. Dr. Gorman did provide a written response that I summarized. Basically, she reinstates that this patient, she did go to an orthopedic doctor for problems back in 2015. She is in a rural area and part of the outreach clinic, and ultimately made it in 2021 to family practice, which then referred her to podiatry. Previously, she was treated with ankle foot arthrosis, anti-inflammatory, physical therapies, injections. When she presented in 2021, Dr. Gorman, she did not want to continue with any additional injections, and they discussed reconstructive surgery at that point. Surgery was then performed as it was planned. There was no deviation. The patient was seen initially post-op. There was a little bit of delay in care because of these outreach clinics and the patient just getting transportation. The patient did, at some point in the recovery, start to develop some nerve pain that was treated with pharmaceuticals. The patient did ultimately return to shoes. The ankle was rolling some. He tried some more conservative measures with orthotics and shoe modifications. And at a point around 2-3 months, the patient then felt a pop feeling. There was radiographic evidence that it was delayed healing of the bone. Stimulator was ordered. Patient ultimately went on for an additional surgical intervention due to lack of bone healing. That did not heal, and then the patient ultimately got another opinion from an orthopedist. To summarize some of the medical records, a lot of the treatment, as I said, was at an outreach clinic, and a lot of it is by nurse practitioners doing some of the post-op work. Past medical history is significant here for knee problems, which concomitantly she was being treated with orthopedic for knee injections during her recovery process, as well for the foot and ankle. Patient had gait abnormality, obesity, some factor five issues, and she was still a smoker. As I mentioned earlier, she had some previous conservative treatment back in 2015 when she was diagnosed with avascular necrosis. That was confirmed by Dr. Berman as well in 2021. When she was first seen, they discussed the options at that point, and reconstructive surgery was discussed. She was seen preoperatively to review a CT scan and to further discuss the surgery that was upcoming. After the surgery, the patient was seen initially by outreach clinics. FMTs were seeing the patient. They were immobilized, and their records seemed to be in good order. About 3 months after the initial surgery, Dr. Gorman notes that the patient was improved, but there was some early nerve pain that was occurring at night. At that point, she was, as I mentioned, treated with gabapentin. At the 3 month mark, thereabouts, she was converted to a CAM boot and then subsequently to a sneaker. And as she started ambulating, there was some pain when she was walking, noted. As she continued to follow up, she had ongoing knee issues that are well documented at the same time. Her ankle was noted to be rolling for patients. There is some documentation of the patient having a varus or a little bit of a hind foot. The patient was reporting the pop formation by the FMT, and the patient was having a little bit of a difficulty due to travel getting in to see Dr. Gorman. It's noted that Dr. Gorman's office did make herself available for the patient, but the patient could not get there. As we go on through the post-op course, initially, as the patient was still having some popping and some rolling, the AFOs and shoe modifications were prescribed. She was also referred to physical therapy. The pain continued when she was ambulating outside of the boot with the shoes. X-ray CT scans were performed again post-operatively, showing that there is a non-union or a delayed union starting. Overall pain at this point was noted to be about 4 out of 10. At 11 weeks, the radiographs are showing that there's good alignment, but there is the joint line still visible. Site overall is relatively non-painful, as documented, but incomplete incorporation of the graft and union site. It was continuing to have pain at that point, had a second procedure performed, which also did not seem to heal. And then ultimately the patient went on for a second opinion orthopedic for reading through some of the notes the patient had a revisional surgery done the third time there. When I look through the financials, I think there's a little bit of unbundling. I don't know how that washed out with the insurance company, but overall everything was booked. Going through the radiograph, it's very obvious that there's a significant deformity upon presentation to Dr. Gorman with an avascular coat. There's significant arthritis, in my opinion, when I look at both the ankle and the subclavian joint. I looked through her radiograph, and I think the procedures were done within a standard of care. And I don't have a problem with what I see on there based on technique. To conclude this, I think that she did present, as I mentioned, with a significant complication. She did have reasonable conservative therapies prior years back. The reconstruction surgical procedures were performed. They didn't heal satisfactory. Second surgery was attempted. Didn't heal. The patient ended up getting a secondary opinion, a third opinion. Another opinion. I think that this, when I look at the reconstructive surgery, I think it was a complicated case. It had a little bit of a trickle-down effect, as when it doesn't heal the first time, it led to other problems that required additional surgeries. I think that's within the standard of care. I don't believe there's a breach in the standard of care in this. I think the surgical procedures that were chosen were appropriate. I don't see a big deviation in technique as well. So that is my summary. I can help answer or clarify anything if we can.
Thank you, Dr. Saunders. Yeah, I'm totally agreement. I mean, you know, when you begin with an avascular necrosis, that's, you know, you're kind of, the whole scenario, it becomes, like you said, quite complicated. I do think, too, that, you know, you can see, obviously, through the documentation, Dr. Gorman's thought process and her plans are well described all over that chart. And one of the other points I'd like to make, too, is when Dr. Diffenbach, the orthopedic surgeon, saw the patient, and he did that first surgery when he removed the hardware and he did all the testing to see if there was any infection, and there was no evidence of any infection going on either. So I really don't have any other questions, just comments that, you know, with all the comorbidities and the difficulties to begin with, the presentation the patient had, this was a very complicated case. And so if I have any questions or comments from my other board members, Dr. Foreman?
No, it was a very complete report, and I agree with what you said also.
Ms. Brahman or Ms. Johnson-Gray?
This is Ms. Johnson-Gray. Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to say I don't have any questions, and the report is very clear. Thank you, Dr. Saunders.
Ms. Brahman?
Has anybody been able to contact her?
No, Dr. Saunders indicated.
He tried, yes.
Mm-hmm. I did not get through.
Okay.
And she did not respond to Ms. Broaddus either for regards to attending this meeting.
Okay, thank you very much. I will agree with everything that's been said so far.
Thank you. All right. Okay, so Mr. Crawford or Dr. Gorman, if you have comments or remarks you'd like to make, we appreciate them.
Yeah, this is Bruce Crawford. Thank you very much for allowing us to appear through the connection. It just didn't work out for either one of us to be here. Dr. Gorman is up in Flagstaff. So I don't really have much to say in terms of adding anything to what Dr. Saunders mentioned. He's absolutely spot on. It was a complicated case from the beginning. Dr. Gorman did appropriate evaluations. She did appropriate recommendations. The surgeries were performed correctly. You know, unfortunately, when you start out with someone that's got pre-existing problems, you know, obviously that takes down the chances of success, and that was explained to the patient. So, you know, I don't have anything. We obviously agree with Dr. Saunders' conclusion. And, you know, the doctor is here really just to answer any additional questions that you may have.
Okay. Now, the only thing I can think of is, Dr. Gorman, this Dr. Campbell, did you think the patient understood the severity of what avascular necrosis means?
I mean, yeah, you hope so. I mean, you know, you spend the time in the room explaining things, and, you know, her AVN was really sick, like, severe. I mean, her entire Taylor body was necrosed. She had fractures all throughout, you know, extending into the ankle, to the Taylor joint. I mean, really, really bad condition. So, you know, you like to think that after, like, you know, multiple conversations explaining that people have a good understanding of the severity of their condition and kind of the you know, complexity of their situation and the treatment involved in it. And ultimately, you know, I sent her for the second opinion, because when we repeated the CT after the second one and I noticed that she wasn't having incorporation of her graft, I told her that. I said at this point, I said, realistically, you're looking at needing like a Blair fusion, you know, like your talus fused to your calcaneus. You'll need like a 3D printed talus implant with like a TTC nail, or you're looking at like, or you can opt for like an amputation, right? Like, you were looking at like limb salvage options at that point. Mm-hmm. And at that time, a few years ago, I didn't have any experience with 3D printed implants. Since then, you know, I've gone on to do those types of cases, but at the time I hadn't. So that's why I actually sent her to Dr. Diefenbach, was because she asked, you know, she said, she's like, well, I'm not ready for an amputation. And I said, okay, well, I want to give you, you know, the option of all the options, right? And so that's ultimately what she ended up having, is they had a 3D printed talus for her, and did a TTC nail with it. So, you know, it's a, you know, complex issue, complex treatment options, and you know, high complication rate, high failure rate. So, you know, you'd like to think that after multiple conversations that there's a clear understanding, but you know, at the same time, we just, you know, you just never know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
I would assume that she has had a good understanding or hasn't, but you know, I can't speak on behalf of the patient. So.
Yeah. Dr. Foreman, or do you have any remarks or questions?
This is Dr. Foreman. Did you explain to the patient about smoking prior to the procedure?
Yes. Yeah, so she said that she had quit smoking a few months prior to me meeting her the first time. So I think she had like a 30-pack year history, but she, I think, had said she had quit like in May, and I think I met her in August.
Thank you. That was all.
Okay. Ms. Broman, you have any questions?
No, I thought that based on the notes and everything, that it was pretty thorough. And it sounds like you tried everything. It seems, as a non-physician, I have no medical experience whatsoever, that based on some of the things that I saw, she had other issues. So if she, I would be shocked if she didn't understand the severity, because as was just mentioned by Dr. Gorman, amputation was one of the options, and you can't get any more severe than that. So I was very, the notes and everything were great.
Thank you. Ms. Johnson Gray?
Yes, I have no questions. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Well, then I am going to go ahead then, as per our discussion and hearing the reports, I will make a motion to dismiss case 24-06-C for Dr. Kedalia Gorman, as there were no violations of state statute.
Second.
Thank you. It's been moved and seconded to dismiss case 24-06-C, seeing no violation of state statutes. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Opposed? The complaint is dismissed. Thank you, Dr. Saunders, very much.
All right, guys. Thanks. Have a good day.
Okay, bye-bye. Our next case is 24-08-C, which is Dr. Bradley Neuschwander. Dr. Neuschwander is on the phone, and again, Mr. Crawford is counsel. complainant is not present, and Dr. Farhani is our investigator, so we will receive Dr. Farhani's report at this point.
Good morning, everyone. This is the investigation report for complaint 24-08-C. I'm Dr. Farhani. The background of this investigation was initiated following a complaint by patient KG, who alleges that her scheduled surgery for her left foot was canceled on three separate occasions without adequate explanation. A thorough review of the medical records and patient's history has been conducted to ascertain the validity of these claims. The possible statute violation was number 22, committing any conduct or practice that might be harmful or dangerous to the health of the patient. Licensee's written response to the allegations KG presented for evaluation on September 30th of 2022 was diagnosed with posterior tendonitis and the dysfunction as well as plantar fasciitis. Following this initial consultation, she was referred to physical therapy and maintained regular follow-up appointments, with the most recent visit recorded on February 26th of 2024. It is important to note that KG has a significant medical history, including prior pulmonary embolism. Given this history, her surgical candidacy required careful consideration. Then we went on a summary of patient visits and interventions. The first visit started on September 30th of 2022. That was the initial consultation. The diagnosis was posterior tendonitis dysfunction and plantar fasciitis. The treatment initiated with conservative care. Imaging results, x-rays revealed talonavicular sag, infracalcaneal spur, calcaneal cuboid arthritis, and elevated first ray ultrasound showed inflamed and plantar fascial ligament. And so the patient routinely saw the doctor, and the last time that the patient was seen was this February 29th of 2024, where the surgery was canceled by patient due to out-of-pocket costs and concerns. And then on March 14th of 2024, surgery was canceled due to inability to obtain a hematologist clearance for the DVT-PE pulmonary embolism prophylaxis, as the patient had history of that. And then on May 28th of 2024, it was decided after reviewing medication and imaging studies, a doctor decided against proceeding with the surgery due to the concern over pain control and risk of worsening symptoms. Recommended other conservative treatment options and suggested a second opinion from another surgeon. Here's my conclusion on this. The decision to conduct surgery became a discussion point by July 2023. Following a review of her imaging results that revealed an old fracture and other complications, Dr. Nushwander engaged KG in discussions about surgical intervention, including a range of procedures aimed at addressing her identified issues. However, he also recognized the necessity of additional assessments, specifically concerning her prior medical history, including pulmonary embolism, and her ongoing pain management plan. Leading up to the scheduled surgeries in early 2024, KG expressed an eagerness to proceed. However, multiple factors influenced the decision to cancel the surgical procedure. On February 29, 2024, the planned surgery was canceled by KG due to concerns regarding her out-of-pocket costs. The surgery scheduled for March 14th of 2024 was also canceled due to her inability to secure a timely clearance from her hematologist regarding a DVT, pulmonary embolism, or PE, as we call it, prophylaxis. The situation intensified when in May 2024, Dr. Nushwander discovered that KG was using a combination of a fentanyl patch, bupivacaine, and Percocet for pain management. After a careful evaluation, including a review of her imaging studies and discussion with a pharmacist, the doctor concluded that proceeding with surgery presented significant risks of uncontrolled postoperative pain and potential complications, including exacerbation of her nerve symptoms. doctor's ultimate decision to cancel the surgical procedure was rooted in medical prudence and commitment to patient safety. He acted in a manner consistent with best practices by prioritizing KG's overall well-being, especially in light of her complex pain management needs and medical history. It is evident that he did not abandon her care. Instead, he sued to explore alternative conservative treatments and recommended that she consider obtaining a second opinion from another surgeon. Upon evaluating the circumstances surrounding KG's complaints, including her ongoing treatment and Dr. Nuswander's through documentation, it is apparent that the allegation of the inadequate explanation for surgery cancellation are unfounded. Doctor's decision were made with a focus of safeguarding the patient's health, and appropriate steps were taken to ensure KG was informed of her options moving forward. Thus finding the support, the conclusion that the complaint lacks substantial merit, that doctor acted ethically and responsibly in this case. I'd just like to add one other note is that as a practicing physician or a surgeon, the doctor can decide whether a procedure can be canceled or not. You know, I always refer this, I've said this many, many years, a surgery is like a painting and an art. You put your signature on it. And if you do it the wrong way, or you're going to harm the patient, that is forever going to haunt you. I would never do a procedure, even though maybe I promised the patient that I would do a procedure, but if all the numbers don't add up, and I feel that this patient is going to, something's going to happen, and you know, we have to also look at it the other way. I mean, it's always the patients complaining against the doctor. But the fact is that what if Dr. Nuswander were to have the surgery on this patient and other complications would have happened? Then that same patient would have complained against the doctor and say, oh, you know what? You didn't watch out for my best, you know, and so unfortunately, yes, maybe I shouldn't say this, but doctors get the short end of the stick. Both sides is really, really sharp. So I honestly don't think that the doctor did anything wrong.
Amen to that. I agree. That was one of my comments I was going to make exactly. If he had done that surgery, sure as shooting, there'd be a complaint.
Yeah, and we would all sit here and rip him apart. That why did you do it knowing that this was the case?
Yeah.
And now he said he doesn't want to do it. He's still getting reprimanded for something that he didn't want to do. So
right,
it's like,
exactly. Yeah, and two, it's like you would want to ask a person who's, you know, is a patient, is like, what would you prefer? Do you prefer someone who's looking out for your best interest and looking at the total picture of the situation?
And you know what? He is so honest.
Yeah.
I don't know this doctor at all. I mean, in fact, I hear most of my colleagues, I know some of them from practice so long, but he also offered the patient a second opinion.
Yes.
If somebody is doing shady stuff or cutting corners, they're never going to tell them to go see a second or a third opinion.
Yes, exactly. So, you got it. I agree. Dr. Foreman, do you have any comments or questions for Dr. Farahani?
No, I agree with both of you. It's a surgeon's discretion.
Ms. Broman?
I totally agree. I was just curious what the, she said that her husband lost his job and he lost his insurance and therefore she couldn't pay for it. It seemed as if the cost went from $2,800 to $1,600 to $615. And then afterwards it says that you got her deposit back, which must have been the $615. So I don't even know whether or not she understood what was going on there. Was he reducing the price for her or was he saying you owe me nothing?
No, Ms. Broman, I think there was a issue with the meeting deductibles and whatnot and so forth and so on. And part of the problem is that there is not enough education for non-medical patients, meaning that not everybody understands out-of-pocket and deductibles. And you know what? You know, they feel like the doctors know the answers to everything. And believe it or not, most of the time I don't even know what the answer is because they make up rules every single day, every year, and there's new things coming out that we don't know. So I always say, with all the respect to patients, you know, they have to take some initiative and they have to do some due diligence on their own. So, you know.
And I believe I read somewhere in the documents that there might have been even two insurance policies at one time, and then when the husband lost the job, you know, that they were down to the one policy.
It looked like she said that they lost. Anyway, I totally agree. The doctor has the right to decide whether or not he's going to operate, and as a layperson listening for as long as I have for these, I think that it was a very, very good decision that they walk away.
Ms. Johnson Gray?
I totally agree.
Thank you.
Alrighty. Hi. Yes, I agree with the investigator's report and the doctor's decision. Thank you.
All right. Dr. Neuschwander or Mr. Crawford, do you have any comments you'd like to make, gentlemen?
Yeah, this is Bruce Crawford again. Thank you for letting us appear telephonically. So I guess just as a lawyer that defends doctors in medical malpractice cases every day, I just have to say, you know, Dr. Neuschwander would have been criticized if he didn't cancel the surgery on the second occasion when the hematology consultation had not been obtained in a timely fashion. That's a significant issue in a patient with a prior pulmonary embolism, and I think if he'd gone ahead at that point without getting it, this board would have criticized him, especially if something went amiss. And then on the pain management issue, you know, unfortunately, it became almost a red flag situation. And again, I think this board would have criticized him if he had gone forward with the surgery when he found out this information. And so, you know, I hear doctors being accused of going ahead with surgery when it's not in the patient's best interest just so they can collect a surgical fee. You know, we have exactly the opposite here. We have a doctor that was concerned, did not want to just go bullheaded forward with a surgery and risk significant complications. And every, you know, the doctors on the board have all seen, you know, the patients with the complex regional pain syndromes issue and everything. So, you know, I understand, I guess, the lady's frustration. But on the other hand, I mean, this is as far away from the doctor doing something other than, you know, in his own interest. This was for the patient's best interest. And so I appreciate the review. And obviously, we agree the case should be dismissed.
Well, you know, we were always taught in school, well, I was, you never do a surgery to make a car payment. And that sticks, you know, that kind of relates back to this. So, Dr. Neuschwander, do you have any remarks?
You know, I don't, other than just thank you for your time and reviewing this. I agree with what's been said in the reports and whatnot. So thank you for reviewing this.
Well, we definitely applaud you, I do, for your action.
Good job.
To not take action. I do have one little question, though. Is it a typical protocol in your office that the surgery scheduler would tell the patient why the surgery was canceled, or do you typically do that yourself?
You know, I typically do when I can get a hold of them. I think in this case, I tried to reach out to her, and I didn't. I think it was my surgical scheduler that told her that, and then I tried to call her later about, you know, second opinion and whatnot. So generally, I try to do it if I can reach them. Sometimes with schedules and being real busy, I end up relying on my staff a little bit for that.
Okay, that's what I figured.
And, you know, one thing that I would recommend, Dr. Neuschwander, is that even if your surgery scheduler is doing or communicating a message on your behalf, and make sure that they document and also write down who was it that they spoke with and who in your staff's like in the time stamp. So that way, in the future date, if, like, you know, Dr. Campbell asked that question, you say, hey, you know what, my staff, her name is Maria, for instance, spoke to this patient on this date on this time, so it makes it easier for you.
That it was documented in the chart, Dr. Farahani. Yes, I found that there was actually one page in that all those documents that actually summarized all the phone calls. I mean, there was separate ones and everything, but it was quite organized. Yeah. All right. Well, I think we're all in agreement here as to for the disposition of this case. So I'm going to make a motion to dismiss case 24-08-C for Dr. Bradley Neuschwander, citing that there are no violations of state statute.
Second.
Thank you. It's been moved and seconded to dismiss case 24-08-C, citing no violations. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed. The case has been dismissed. Thank you very much, everybody.
All right, thank you, doctor.
Okay, you guys have happy holidays. Merry Christmas, happy Hanukkah, whatever.
You too.
Thank you.
You're an assistant attorney general. I think you should be a model.
Do my AG calendar.
Bye-bye, Dr. Farahan. All righty, let's move on to B, which is issuance of licenses. We have one application here, Dr. Joseph Krupa. Dr. Krupa's application's complete. I don't see any issues here. Does anyone have any questions or concerns regarding this application? Okay, hearing none.
Board Member Johnson Gray, I was going to say I do not.
Okay, thank you so much. So I will make a motion to accept the application of Dr. Joseph Krupa, DPM, for regular licensure, seeing that the application is complete, all fees are paid, and to issue that license upon payment of the issuance fee.
Seconded.
Thank you. It's been moved and seconded to accept the initial application for licensure of Dr. Joseph Krupa. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion for licensure for Dr. Krupa has been accepted. Thank you. All righty. Next item on the agenda is a review, possible discussion, action on the update from the Federation of Podiatric Medical Boards meeting of, it was November 21st, regarding the Interstate Podiatric Medical Licensure Compact. So I'll let Heather make some remarks and I'll see if she says what I'm going to say and we'll go from there.
Thank you, Madam Chair, board members. I have a couple of remarks. I would like to correct what I had told the board at one of the previous meetings regarding when the compact would become effective. I believe I said that it requires 7 jurisdictions to run legislation before it becomes effective, but it's actually 4. So I just wanted to make that clarification, correction. Also, I did have some questions regarding the renewal process, but all of those were answered. I have no concerns with that process, but I do still have some concerns with the criminal background check that the compact is requiring. I did reach out to the compact organizer and did ask that question. I have not gotten a response back. I can answer any other questions that the board members may have regarding the compact, but that's my only question.
Yeah. And one of the other things that was mentioned in the meeting is that the compact committee is going to be reaching out to the state associations. Well, they did. Apparently, after we had the meeting in the morning, then they met with the state associations. I do not know if Arizona was present at that meeting. And they're just seeing what the interest is in compact and their the interest of having state associations be the one that run the legislation for to become members of a compact. So again, we're still, we're kind of in this, the compact is what's considered an alternative pathway to getting multiple licenses, and that physicians are held to higher standards they each have their own home state license, but can, you know, then you can, through the compact, apply for the other, you know, other states that a physician would like to have a license in. Anyway, so again, this is still, you know, in the developing stage, so we'll just, you know, keep you posted. That we have a, the Federation has a, we have a meeting on Wednesday, what's that date, Heather?
December 18th.
December the 18th, which is for board, you know, the state boards to meet. And I do believe the speaker at that meeting is one of the gentlemen that's, I think he's the attorney, one of the attorneys that's involved in the PAC, or the compact. So hopefully, Heather, and we can get that question answered for Heather at that meeting as well. So, but we'll follow up in January with that information. So, anybody have any questions? And that, you know, was it last month when Heather put into the board package, she put all that information in there from the compact. So if people had questions or concerns, that's a good resource for information. So, okay. Alrighty. So our next, I'm not hearing that anybody has any questions or concerns on that. That if there's anything you would like us to ask at the meeting, please email that to Heather if you think of something, and then we can, because then what, you know, if the state association runs legislation, then the board will need to decide, you know, if, you know, if they're backing, you know, if they support the legislation that's being brought forth. So,
And Madam Chair, board members, I would just like to say too that I'm sure that if the association were to, you know, try to find a sponsor to run the legislation, that the board would be very much involved in that process. I also want to let board members know that any board member can attend the Federation meetings. So if you're interested, I could always forward the Zoom meeting link to you, and it is always, you know, just virtual, just a Zoom link, or you can call into the meeting if any other board member has interest in those meetings.
Thank you. That's, yeah. All righty. So our next item is number 7 here, which is review, discussion, and possible action regarding a draft bill which would impact health board's website and time limitation requirements. So have Heather take care of that.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, board members. Representative Contreras reached out to all of the health boards regarding a bill that he plans to introduce next session. And basically the language just changes posting non-disciplinary and disciplinary consent agreements or orders on the board's website from 5 years to 25 years. And I would just like to let some of the board members know that maybe haven't been with the board for very long, may not know this information. The 25-year time frame has historically been around for a really long time. The last administration with former Governor Ducey changed that time frame from 5 years. So basically this would just be changing it back to the original time frame. And it also requires that non-disciplinary letters of concern be posted on the board's website, which historically letters of concerns have not been posted on any health board's websites that I'm aware of. And he's asking for any kind of feedback. So if any board member has you know, any concerns or anything like that, please let me know so I can let Representative Contreras and his staff know. Yes, and I would ask that, you know,
yes. But if they bring in, like, if they have comments, and then the board can vote next time whether to support it or not in January, do you agree with that?
Oh, the board can't take action on it now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can they at least state if they have any concerns?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it'll be, yeah.
Madam Chair, board members, this is Heather Broaddus again. So if the board has any concerns or anything like that, we could put it on the January agenda. I would like to say that Representative Contreras does plan to hold a meeting next Wednesday. So if the board has concerns, I could, you know, take them to Representative Contreras at that time. I can answer any questions.
I mean, I support, I think, you know, from the aspect of, and I would be curious what our public members say about it, is, you know, when you have, people are always looking for information about providers before they select them, you know, to go, you know, and I think most people would be pleased to see that information. Now, I know there would be obviously some physicians who probably are going to maybe not appreciate the letters of concern being on there, but that's part of the record. So that's, you know, I would support it. I think, you know, that way it's out there, it's transparent and all those things that, you know, and I just think, you know, I would be in support of it. So I really don't have any other concerns that I can think of.
I think if the board's in support of it, it would be appropriate to, you know, maybe not vote to be in support of it this time, but to direct Heather to attend that meeting in support of the bill.
For information gathering?
Sorry, for information gathering.
Okay, so would you like that in a motion? Or can we just direct
her? You could just direct her.
Okay, so.
So can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
This is Broman. I'm sorry. So it's changing the time frame for the posting. The posting, if there is an issue with the physician, would remain on the website for 25 years instead of 5. Is this what I'm understanding?
That's
or am I not
correct. That's correct. Currently, the currently we have a board actions page on our website where any individual can go to our website and find any disciplinary or non-disciplinary action that's been taken against a podiatrist within the last 5 years. So if this new language becomes effective, it would be up there for 25 years.
So let me ask the physicians on this call, is there something between 5 and 25 years that would be more fair than 25 years? Or is 25 years something that you all say, yeah, that makes sense? 25 years seems like a long time.
I think that's ridiculous. 25 years is way too long.
See, and that's the kind of information that we need to bring for Heather to go to this meeting and see where, you know, I think 25 is long, but I would support longer than the 5 years, because I think, you know.
I agree longer than 5 years, but 25 years seems really. And the other thing is that, and I know I've looked this up for some doctors, but sometimes you look and you say, okay, there is a letter here, and maybe the letter was regarding communication, and they fixed it or whatever. There's nothing saying that. I mean, there's a difference between a communication letter of concern versus a you did something wrong and stuck this in the wrong spot, or, you know. So it's even the way it's done on the website, if you see that there's some kind of negative towards a doctor, you go, oh, no, I'm not using them. You don't look and see what it is or what it was. And that is my concern for 25 years.
I think it's important to note, too, this is Seamus, just to state, just to throw it out there, that those disciplinary actions are always available. They can always be requested. They just don't show up on the website.
Is that through a public records request?
Yes.
Madam Chair, board members, this is Heather Broaddus. If I could I guess just to kind of tell you my thoughts on it, in that this board's retention schedule is required to keep disciplinary actions for 7 years. So anything that is more than 7 years old is essentially destroyed. So that information is unavailable. It will always be kept in our database, but the actual file itself and, you know, the order itself is purged.
Is this for new claims, or is this going to go back, let's say that 25 years passes, are they going to go back 25 years and post all non-disciplinary letters of concern?
That would be a question I would have, probably for Seamus, if this legislation passes, if I have to go back and put all of the orders that I took down back up.
That's a
I don't know.
Sounds like it would be.
Be retroactive, okay.
Yeah, I don't know that. We would have to, you know, if the legislation passes, we would have to consult with.
Do you know, was there an event that stimulated this coming back?
I don't know.
Okay. I was just going to ask that. Thank you. Yeah.
My guess would just be the change in administration.
Mm-hmm. This is Board Member Johnson Gray. I was going to say, from my legal hat on, that 25 years is cumulative, very. And before Heather stated that it was set, that we hold it for 7 years, that makes sense. I just wanted to state that, they don't even hold anything on your credit longer than 7 years. And 25 years is just, That's
severe.
So I just wanted to
say
that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so that meeting, Heather, is Wednesday, the 18th.
Mm-hmm. So Heather will go and bring your concerns and report back with information, and we'll agendize it for a potential position from the board.
Anything else anybody would like, Heather? And again, if you come up with something else before Wednesday, let Heather know if you have another concern, so.
What would this board believe is the right amount? 7 to 10? 10 at the most?
Yeah, I
mean, if we're gonna say we don't like 25, we're gonna have to say
we'd be comfortable with such a
think is fair.
But we can't take a position right now. That would be something that once Heather comes back from the meeting with and having given our concerns to them, that she would have more information, and then we could discuss and see what our stance is on time frames and such. Because I'm sure curious what the other boards are going to say, what the DOs are going to say, and the MDs and PTs and everybody else.
And Madam Chair, board members, this is Heather Broaddus again. I would just like to also say that this board's retention schedule, last time I checked at least, unless there's been a change, is almost identical to the medical board's retention schedule.
Yeah.
Well, it will have to do with the bill itself, though. Because if it's written notwithstanding, then your retention schedules really don't apply.
Right.
Because it's...
notwithstanding any other law,
it can't be overarching. It's overarching.
It would negate our retention.
Okay.
Potentially, but something we can talk about.
Okay.
Later.
Okay, so we'll revisit this next in January. Okay. Let me just make a note here. Okay, so. I know. Okay, big time here. Okay, so now we're moving on to number 8, which is review, discussion, possible vote on personnel issues pertaining to evaluation of our executive director, Ms. Broaddus. As you can see in the packet, we have evaluation forms, performance review that Heather has shown.
You make a motion to go into executive session.
Yeah. So at this time, in order to discuss personnel issues, I'll make a motion to move into executive session, pardon me, for discussion regarding discussion of personnel matters.
Also, inspection of potentially confidential information.
Okay, and for inspection of possible confidential information associated with this item.
And for legal advice
also. I think Dr. Foreman has seconded, moved and seconded to move into executive session. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
So moved.
Perfect.